I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. The key battle taking place in this American crisis year of 2024 is happening in our heads, according to the master historian, Richard Slotkin. He's here to tell us all that we're in a 40-year culture war and an identity crisis by now. It's all about drawing on legendary figures like Daniel Boone and Frederick Douglass, Betsy Ross and Rosa Parks, Robert E. Lee and G.I. Joe for a sort of composite self-portrait of the country. You say, Richard Slotkin, we're in a contest of origin stories in search of a common national myth, as you put it. This book of yours has taken me by storm. A Great Disorder, you titled it. Subtitle, National Myth and the Battle for America. It is the Trump-Biden fight, of course, but with centuries of history bubbling under it. Walk us around this battlefield, please, where MAGA comes alive in your telling. It is not just a Trump slogan on a red cap.
I guess I have to start by saying that one of the things that my book tried to do is to trace the origin of the culture war, to define the culture war by the way in which the two sides use national mythology. National myth is one of the basic structures that holds a nation state together. You're born to your family, you're born to your neighborhood, your community. You have to learn to think of yourself as a national, as someone who belongs to America. And the way that nation states have done that from their origin is to invent a national myth history, a version of their origins that give people the sense when they identify with it that they belong to a community that is continuous in time. And that makes a certain amount of sense. And the United States, of all modern nations, is in some ways the most dependent on these stories because our ethnic and racial origins are so varied, perhaps the most varied in the world at this point. And so we need a common story to bind us together. And we have in the past had four basic stories that have developed out of our history and that we've told ourselves to define who we are. The oldest one is the myth of the frontier. It's the idea that we're a settler state, that we were established in the wilderness, that we grew by expanding into that wilderness, and that we define ourselves by struggling against a primitive enemy, a primitive landscape, for the possession of a continent that's just filled with vast natural resources.
And wealth.
Wealth, yeah. It's about growth. The thing about frontier growth is that it's not just nickel and dime. It's a bonanza. It's a gold rush. It's a coal rush. It's an oil rush. It's a real estate rush as much as anything. So that's the first one. That's the oldest one. That really goes back to colonization. The second one is what I call the myth of the founding. Comes out of the American Revolution. It's the idea that the nation was started by a group of extraordinarily wise white men who defined a set of principles by which we could live our national existence and gave us a legal system, a constitutional system that would define us as democratic forever. And there's a nice little contradiction there in that the Declaration of Independence is about revolution, overthrow of government, and the Constitution is about preserving government and stabilizing government. Yeah. And that's the second one.
The founding also becomes almost a miracle. These genius men with a divine blessing.
Yes, the Declaration and the Constitution have become a kind of secular scripture. And the status of the founders, when we appeal to them, the whole point of myth, by the way, is that it's a story to which you can appeal for authority in your beliefs. So when we appeal to the founding, we're appealing to supposedly a set of fixed and permanently good beliefs. The third one, the third myth, is really a myth complex. It's the Civil War, and it's got three main variants. It's all about preserving the unity of the nation in the struggle over slavery and race. And the first version is what I call the liberation myth or the Lincoln myth. It's the saving the Union and emancipating the slaves creates a new birth of freedom, as Lincoln called it. And the second one I call the white reunion. And that's the idea that 50 years after the Civil War, we realized it was really just a battle between brothers, that the white North and the white South were the same, and black people didn't belong. And then the third one is the lost cause. And that's the South's myth, which justifies the use either of secession or of extraordinary violence to either preserve white supremacy or to reestablish white supremacy when it's been overthrown by the end of slavery. And those are the three myths, and those are really, in some ways, the most important at the moment. And then there's a fourth one, the newest of the myths, which dates from the 1940s. I call it the Good War myth. And this is the myth of the platoon movie.
Interesting.
Comes out of World War II, that the United States is this multi-ethnic, multi-racial platoon democracy joined together to fight against a common enemy, Nazism, the Japanese Empire. And the power of this myth is twofold. On the one hand, it is, for the first time, an American myth that uncompromisingly says we are multiracial, we are multi-ethnic, all equal within that structure. Mm. The second element is that the unity is in some way dependent upon war, upon the existence of an enemy whose difference transcends the differences that divide Americans.
It's so interesting and complex. You mentioned the platoon movies. There was a platoon movie, but there are many platoon movies. I immediately think of Stalag 17, William Holden. But there's always a certain balance, certain tension, but complexity in the people we send.
Oh, yes. One of the things about these myths is, you know, I've described it in a kind of a schematic way. But each one is a complex story with multiple characters and possibilities. The frontier, for example, you can tell that story as white man beats Indian. But you can also tell the story as white man goes to the Indian and gets in touch with a more natural kind of religion and a better approach to nature. Hmm. Civil War, you know, well, three different versions. And the Good War, yeah, there are tensions within the platoon. There are power struggles within the platoon. Yeah. But there is this basic structure.
Who stitches these myths into the ones that prevail and survive, and how? It takes a certain genius to define and embed a myth. How does it happen?
Well, it's a long process, and it really happens as the various media of cultural expression that have existed and developed over, what, 300 years now, as these media process historical experience. You get a crisis, King Philip's War in the colonial period. Hmm. Every writer in the colonies has to respond to it in some way. You build up a body of interpretations, and over time, some of these interpretations seem to grip people, seem to strike people as more useful to understanding the past and interpreting the present than other versions. And from that gradual process, you get story formulas that develop over time. One of the differences in the different ages of American history is that as you get towards the age of mass media, that process is speeded up. So, for example, it took, I would say, a generation for the myth of the frontier, as I've defined it, to really take hold in colonial culture. The myth of the Good War is created in 20 years. It's formulated by Hollywood. It catches on. It spreads like wildfire. The politicians say, oh my God, this is a much better way to talk about the United States than to talk about it as the land of white supremacy. Mm. The Cold War says, definitely, you got to talk about the United States, not racially segregated, but open to all. So you get a kind of acceleration of the process. Just as a technical thing, one of the things that you can look for as you study this is the way in which movie genres develop over time. A genre is like the seed of a myth.
Speak of the battleground in 2024, but in the 21st century generally, what's the key confrontation here?
If you want to see what myths are in play as we're talking, if you look at the videos of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, You see the flags that the rioters are carrying. Every one of those flags is a symbol that invokes a mythic story. You've got, for example, the Betsy Ross flag and the Gadsden flag, the rattlesnake. Don't tread on me. Okay, that's the myth of the founding. They're appealing to the founding fathers. They're saying, what we're doing here is what the fathers did in 1776. Gadsden flag specifically ties to the gun rights movement and says that the Second Amendment and the right to use firearms as you will is the key to what America is all about. Again, myth of the founding, but in that case also myth of the frontier, myth of the gunfighter, myth of the vigilante, and then, of course, the Confederate battle flag, myth of the lost cause. What are we doing here? We're using violence to restore an old order that was being overthrown by a combination of liberals and their racial clients. And that's exactly the script of the lost cause.
The power of these myths could serve any number of causes. They could serve gun rights as well as civil rights or voting rights. But in the net, it seems to me, this myth-based moment tilts mostly right. Could a left-wing politics of economic democracy, for example, or equality find a foundation in these myths?
Well, there are, but you go to different myths. There's no way to get away from white supremacy if you're talking in the terms of the myth of the lost cause. So if you look at the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and in a way the Black Lives Matter movement, let's call it the George Floyd protest movement in 2020, there the appeal was made to figures like Abraham Lincoln. Mm. That's an appeal to the myth of the liberation. And for liberals, in a way, that is the oldest, deepest, and most broadly accepted version of national myth. One of the sort of periods in the struggle for social justice that doesn't get mythologized, but that liberals do appeal from time to time, is the New Deal. Mm. And it's really quite extraordinary that such a major transformation in American politics has not become the subject of the kind of storytelling that you get from Custer's Last Stand, let's say, an utterly trivial battle, or even an important battle like Gettysburg. But you don't get a lot of movies about the Ford sit-down strike, for example, or TVA. One of the weaknesses of the left has been its difficulty in appealing to even those phases of our history that would be useful. Now, the most useful myth, and Obama used to appeal to this quite a lot, is the Good War myth, because of its multiracial aspect. And the problem with that myth is that it is so associated with military conflict that it becomes difficult to embrace it in an unambiguous way if you're on the left. And last point about the left is based on criticism. Hmm. On analysis of a tradition that has gone wrong. And criticism is the antithesis of myth. Myth is about belief. Myth is about taking a story for granted. And criticism is about, don't take it for granted. Look inside it. And so the left's task as a cultural task is how to balance criticism and belief.
You make an interesting point that it was Ronald Reagan who thought up neoliberal economics, but it was Bill Clinton, actually, who enacted it. That is to say, the government's retreat from the economic marketplace, the elevation of market power.
When the Great Society crashed, you get really the end of what has been called the New Deal order. And Reagan, the slogan for that is that government is the problem, not the solution. And it moves towards what's called neoliberal economics, which is essentially a deregulated marketplace, in which government, to the extent that it acts at all, acts in support of business rather than regulating and taxing business primarily. And Reagan actually is a fairly moderate practitioner of the doctrine, but he does get this notion enacted that you can cut taxes and still balance the budget, which you can't, and which he discovered you couldn't by ballooning the deficit. So Clinton comes along and he adopts the neoliberal economic model. But he says, let's do it sensibly. Let's balance the budget by raising taxes, which is the traditional way to do things. But Clinton also says the age of big government is over. So what you've got really succeeding, taking the place of what should have been the continuous history of the New Deal, is the anti-New Deal, is a return to a kind of laissez-faire model of freedom, the marketplace, and so on. That model becomes more radicalized, more systematically stated, as you get through into the 1990s with people like Grover Norquist, the anti-tax movement, no new taxes, the anti-tax pledge, and so on, shrinking government, deregulation. It's a very important economic policy, and it's anti-union is the other aspect of it. It's anti-labor, and it has its effect in freezing wages, what's called wage stagnation, through this period, increasing economic injustice. I should say, though, that neoliberal economics is not the whole story, that there's a counter tendency within conservatism, the Pat Buchanan populist tendency, which dates also from the 1990s, which says, anti-tax, fine. Yeah, we're all for that. But what about cultural values? What about maintaining racial discipline in the cities? What about sexual discipline and sexual good order? What about religious values and so on? And that, while it's harmonious with Reagan conservatism, it also is at odds with the economic doctrine.
This is so interesting. I wanted to ask you about the sort of standing of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. By any measure, one of the great, great presidents of the United States, he embodied a certain myth of this heroic nation suffering together equally through depression and then war. And yet he's not somehow in our living mythology. What happened? Have we lost touch with that man, that time, or what?
I think we have lost touch with the man and the time. I describe myths as growing by a process of storytelling and use. And if you follow the storytelling from, let's say, the 1930s through the Lyndon Johnson administration, there is a certain referentiality to Roosevelt and the New Deal, which is positive. It gets a lot of blowback because it is so exceptional in American history. But Johnson embraced it, and Johnson embraced the figure of FDR. In fact, he used to cultivate his resemblance as if, you know, he was FDR's illegitimate son or something. That's myth. That's the use of myth. And then what happened? The Great Society crashed, first because of Vietnam.
Yes.
That brought the administration down. And then the struggle for social justice produced disorder in the cities and a tremendous white backlash against the changes that the Johnson administration was making and against the civil rights movement as well. And that reaction produced Reagan and Reaganism and a real conservative turn in American culture and politics. And that's the breach in storytelling. And one of the things that's interesting about Joe Biden is his deliberate attempt to bring back the reference to the New Deal and to Roosevelt. Remains to be seen whether it will take.
You say it's a storytelling medium. Does the left know how to tell a story?
They have known in the past, but no, they're not telling the story well, I guess is what I have to say there. You don't get the kind of coherence of a story unfolding from the origin to the present from the way that most liberal spokesmen talk about things. Certainly not in the academy. But then the academy is about criticism. It's not about fabricating. Nobody is writing on the left a great American novel. That whole movement, it lasted through the 50s, that writers would compose a fable, a narrative that would sum up what the country was about, teach Americans what they were. Nobody's writing that kind of narrative anymore. And that kind of writing, novel writing, movie script writing, folk songs, not being done. The cultural work is not being done.
Did we ever do it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
When was the last great liberal story of America?
60s folk revolution.
Interesting.
Going back to Woody Guthrie, all of those songs about social change and social justice, Times They Are a Change, and Bob Dylan. That was where the storytelling was being done in that period. If you go back to the New Deal itself, there's tremendous storytelling that's done by New Deal spokesmen, by the Writers Project, the WPA, the artists who painted those American history-based murals in the post offices around the country. A tremendous outpouring of creativity in defining American nationality. So it's been done before.
Question remains, though, is contest defined in myths, can it possibly be fair? Is it ever tested for truth? Do myths get debated? Do they compete for sort of permanence or rank?
They do compete, that's for sure. And they do get tested. Let's just set aside for the moment what I said, that academics exist and make their living criticizing myths. Just put that to one side. One of the things that happens in a mythological process is a myth is the usable path. So you put the myth to use and you test it when you put it to use. For example, one of the first myths that we had in the colonial period was called a captivity myth, that the symbol of the American colony was a white woman captured by Indians, helpless, victimized. And that myth fades as the colonies gain confidence, as they start to push back the wilderness. The new story is not the Indian captive, but the white man who rescues the Indian captive, and that becomes the Daniel Boone story. Now, in our time, the myth that has been tested most recently is the Good War myth. Mm. The Good War myth goes, there's an evil order out there, an evil empire, an evil dictator. You have a choice. Either you oppose them or you appease them. You appease them, Chamberlain, you get World War II, and you have to have the platoon movie fight and win World War II. Well, American leaders appealed to that myth to get Americans to support the war in Vietnam, and it didn't work. Hmm. So they appealed to it again, the H.W. Bush administration, it appealed to again in the Gulf War against Saddam, and it worked. Americans united the whole world against Saddam, so it worked. Okay. One failure, yeah, but as Bush said, we've defeated Vietnam syndrome. So what happens? His son does Iraq and Afghanistan. They're fake wars. There was no Hitler. There was no real threat coming to the country from either of those sources. The myth is discredited. You fooled me once with Vietnam, okay. You fooled me twice with Afghanistan, okay. You fooled me three times with Iraq, I don't think so. Now you come to me with Ukraine, and Ukraine is a classic good war scenario case. You have your Hitler Putin, you have your innocent country being invaded, you have your choice to appease or oppose. And the reason why Americans initially flocked to Ukraine was, oh my God, I've seen this movie before. I know how this movie goes. I know what side I have to be on. And then the reaction sets in. Wait a minute. We fell for this line before. Not falling for it again. Going to be skeptical about it this time. Going to think about it this time.
Richard Sutkin, this is deeply interesting and contradictory. It becomes almost a rule in your telling of the story that either you get yourself in line with an appropriate combination of American myths or you die. And yet there are surprises. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, for example. Take that apart in the myths that are at play.
Well, first of all, who's sitting behind King while he makes the speech?
Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. And he's attacking the segregationist South. And he appeals to the Declaration of Independence, America's holy book. And he appeals to the Bible. And he puts the two together. And the brilliance of that speech is his mingling the traditional imagery of American myths, Jefferson, Declaration of Independence, Abraham Lincoln, with the rhetoric of the black church, so that the black church in that speech becomes the ultimate expression of Abraham Lincoln's America. And that's brilliant rhetoric, but that's a brilliant use of myth. That's a brilliant appropriation of myth. Contrast that with the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, in which many of the demonstrators attacked statues of Lincoln and of people who fought for the North in the Civil War, as well as attacking Confederate statues, for which I say Godspeed, but attacking Lincoln as well, because it's all part of the white supremacy. That's not understanding how to use your story.
I want you to take apart the MAGA myths and how they came together, but also Donald Trump's myth of himself. You make an interesting point that this has been going on, this has been building for 20 years, and it's more rooted than a lot of us would have thought or had seen. How did MAGA come together as a kind of composite competitive myth?
Let me say, first of all, that the way Trump works is he's a blank screen or a puppet of resentment onto which people can project whatever myth and symbol they want to do. That's his power as a public figure. He appropriates his people's notions, but he brings very little to the table himself. Here's what I see the roots of MAGA as being. I see it really as a kind of repeat of the lost cause. That you've got a segment of American society, mainly white, middle class, mainly Christian, who have experienced a loss of cultural power over the past, well, 40 years, more than 40 years, really starting in the 1960s. That is dismaying to them. It was dismaying when it was restricted simply to the media, the 60s media, rock and roll, that whole popular culture thing. But when, starting with Bill Clinton, and most particularly with Barack Obama, when people representative of the culture of the 60s, that multiracial, sexually liberated, culturally liberated, secular culture system, when they gained power, then it was the sign to these people that the loss was more than a loss of popular culture, that it was a real loss of genuine authority, and that their safety and their identity was being threatened and challenged. So that I see as being the basis of it. Now, the second component of it is, Okay, how do you respond to that? And here, your choice of histories, your choice of myths is, to my mind, very troubling. The lost cause. Identifying with the lost cause, you identify with violence. Mm. You say that democracy is a secondary value. The preservation of civilization, Christian civilization, is a much higher value. And that is said quite literally by Christian nationalists, but it's really being said quite broadly by people in the MAGA stream. Bill Barr, for example, the former attorney general, is quite definitely in that school of thought. So you have to save civilization, you have to resort to violence. The second thing is gun rights movement. Starting in the 1990s, the gun rights movement became associated with anti-government, the anti-government movement. It's partly coming out of Grover Norquist's anti-tax movement, but it goes deeper than that. There's an old legal theory called the Palladium Theory from 1833 that the Second Amendment is the guarantor of our liberties because by giving people the right to bear arms, actually it allows a state militia to resist a tyrannical federal government. And what happened in the 1990s was first the gun rights movement made that an individual right, not a militia right. I think it's Fred Romero, one of the NRA spokesmen, said it's a gun pointed at the head of government. Mm. It keeps government honest by threatening to overthrow it. By the time you get to Obama's administration, you get people saying we have got to have Second Amendment remedies for the Affordable Care Act. They're bringing guns to town meetings for congressmen. And the ultimate moment of that is the attack on Congress on January 6th. And the violence, the threats of violence that have happened since against public officials, election officials, and so on. So there's the Second Amendment, myth of the founding, lost cause, myth of the Confederacy, both of which justify the use of violence and the substitution of power for democracy. Autocracy, in other words, yeah.
I want to hear you on missing myths and also alternative myths. The big missing one today, one of them, is the nation of immigrants, our history of immigration. It's no longer fashionable or considered a driving myth. The nation of nations, the melting pot, which was a myth I grew up with. What happened?
It was absorbed into the Platoon movie.
It's good, but it's got to go to war or something?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the way we formulated it. I hear that what you're asking for, and this is the critical thing, is can you detach the ethnic racial liberalism element from the Platoon movie? And I would add also the social justice movement, because the Platoon movie in some ways incorporates the New Deal, the whole idea of equality and democracy that comes out of the New Deal. Can you detach those stories from this fable, which has been operative for us, the Good War fable? The only thing I can say is it hasn't been done. Mm. Nobody has told the story in that way. I think what you would have to do is to look at a different frame of action in which, let's call it, this platoon is operative. If, for example, a movie were made about immigrant and black workers coming together. Well, you know, it's that movie, Matewan. Do you remember that movie?
No.
It's about coal miners in West Virginia, a coal strike, and it involves not only the West Virginia native whites, but Italian immigrants who have been brought in as scabs and blacks who have been brought in as scabs who end up joining the union fight together. It was a John Sayles movie, and forgive me, but I've forgotten the date of it. It's pretty damn old. If a lot of movies like that were to suddenly appear, if people were to become interested in the social movement struggle of labor or the civil rights movement, and to start telling stories about that, heroic stories, then you would see a new myth being tested in the marketplace. But all I can say as a historian is, Sayles made the movie, and it was a very good movie, and there's no genre there. There's no follow-on there. So the culture has not made a place for that. Now, partly I would say it's the fault of the people who control media. They don't want a union story out there. But where are the novels? You know, where are the comic strips? Where are the graphic novels about that?
Speak of another missing myth or alternative myth, the anti-imperial myth of this country, which found its freedom in the 1770s in rebellion against the greatest empire of the world, Britain. That stands in tension, at least, with the picture of our empire today, greater than the British Empire, more violent, the successor empire. There are big elements of this country in both parties that fall happily into the role of imperialist. How did this happen?
That's the frontier. We lived the frontier, and the frontier kept going. And then around 1900, Theodore Roosevelt extended the frontier to the Philippines and the Pacific Basin and Latin America. And we've just followed this pattern of growth, growing power, growing influence, and so on. The twist in that came with the Good War myth in the 1940s, where you change the notion of American power from an imperial view to a liberating view, that we're not going to Vietnam to make them an American colony. We're going to free them, and then we leave, and then we walk away. We're not going to take charge of anything. It didn't work. It wasn't true. Same thing with Iraq. It didn't work.
And Afghanistan.
It wasn't true.
And Indochina generally.
And Afghanistan and so on.
Ukraine is a piece of it.
But understand the two ways of thinking about it. That on the one hand, you have the good intentions. Think about Obama's reaction to the two wars. He said the Iraq war was a bad war. It was a stupid war. It was unnecessary. But the Afghan war, he said that made sense. Because we might be able, if we concentrated there, we could actually have transformed that society in a democratic way. And I don't want to get into whether that he was right or wrong. I think he was wrong. But what I want to focus on is the dream. What I want to focus on is the way of thinking about it. That it's a different way of thinking about it that can sometimes trap you into following the same imperial path. But how you think about it is different. Now, contrast that with Trump, who says, I don't want to be in Iraq. I want to get out of Iraq. But if I'm in Iraq, I want the oil. I mean, there's your empire. He's so simple that way. He just says it flat out. I'll take the oil, thank you.
Most of my lifetime has been a succession of failures of that imperial hope, if there was such a hope. Are we impervious to learning lessons in the context of these myths? Like, we're not very good imperialists.
Remains to be seen. We're really trying to work this through with respect to Ukraine at the moment. And there's a way of thinking about it that makes mythic sense, but no political sense. When are we going to think about things in a balanced and real way?
Big question.
I don't know the answer to that. The thing about myth is that when it's invoked, you recognize it. You say, my God, I've seen this movie before. I know it. And so it's one up on your brain. You've already consented that this is a story that applies to the case before me. Mm. And it's very, very difficult to disentangle from that, to see through that. If you follow the political discourse, they're still talking in terms of these symbols. And in a way, how else can you talk on television? You know, are you going to do a whiteboard display for every point that you're trying to make? We need to talk in symbols. It's how humans are. It traps us, but it's how we are.
Richard Slotkin, you write that we are virtually two nations by now. It sounds a little psychoanalytic or maybe schizophrenic, examining the great disorder of dream spaces, identity spaces of a great nation. How do we cope with it?
I don't know that we can. I think that this is a test. This is going to be a test. At the moment, what you see happening is state governments dividing on culture war lines. So that if the logic of this movement continues, you're going to have two different legal systems in the country. Hmm. Different on not only things like abortion, but voting rights, different way of organizing democracy, different education system, different way of teaching American history, different way of understanding sex, for crying out loud, depending on what state you live in. How can you have those differences enforced in law and culture over a generation and not just fatally split the consciousness that sustains this sense that we are all in some ways American? You also got in this conversation people who say the other guys are not American. I think it's Glenn Elmers, writes for Claremont Review, said that there's only about 75 million real Americans in the country. And the rest can't be called Americans by any stretch of the imagination because they don't believe the things that a real American believes. Now, that's not racial. That's ideological. And the government should be run by the real Americans, that fraction should be empowered to run the government. On the other hand, you get people say that MAGA is not who we are. Well, yeah, if you're an American, you have to admit MAGA is a piece of who we are. The Lost Cause is a piece of who we are. It's our history there. And you got to come to terms with that.
What we're looking for, you keep writing, is myths that unite us more than they divide us.
Yes.
What would such a myth look like in the 21st century?
The only thing I can think of is a myth that would take off from the Declaration of Independence, all men created equal, and the Lincoln myth, the Lincoln idea of a republic based on free elections, racial equality, would incorporate the New Deal idea of social justice and economic justice, above all, economic justice, and the civil rights movement, again, racial justice, and would tell that story as the development of America. I would emphasize that it's not a story of perpetual triumph. What it's a story of is a perpetual struggle of a nation that was a multiracial nation that thought it could be all white at the start and struggled with that and got past slavery. And then did Jim Crow and struggled with that and got past that and had economic oppression and inequality and struggled with that and tried to get past that and still struggles with it and tries to get past that. So if you tell it as the story of a struggle for an ideal, which is democratic and egalitarian and just, then I think you have a story. I think you have a story worth telling. I think you'll have incidents that make sense. You'll have some people who are heroes who fall out of the frame. Andrew Jackson, goodbye. General Custer, goodbye. And others that come forward, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Tecumseh, Red Cloud, Aguinaldo in the Philippines, people who struggled against America, but the struggle was a question, you know, is it just what you're doing? Is it right what you're doing? I don't think so. I have a point of view as well. Consider that. So a story of struggle in those terms for racial, social, and economic justice.
It's Hollywood, movies, over the years that has made and broken our mythology. Did the Hollywood president, Ronald Reagan, have an advantage in that background?
He was recognizable as a good guy. He brought that to the screen. You could make a parallel there with Trump, who makes his bones as a reality show host on The Apprentice and basically brings the same persona to the presidency. And he's recognized. I mean, we understand who he is because he comes from the world of entertainment that we all know. I think the way that Reagan played his role is more important than the fact that he was a Hollywood guy. George Murphy, the senator from California, was a Hollywood guy who, you know, nobody really cared. So give Reagan cred for playing the role of the president.
Immediately, I think of something you don't much talk about in the book, but I think it's got to be important, and that's sports as an arena of defining what America is. Jackie Robinson, is there a better story of this country in my lifetime or yours? I don't think so. And now, of course, it's compounded by women's stories. The incredible Caitlin Clark playing basketball. What's the promise of great sports myths?
This is a seedbed of potential stories, which, as you point out, have a common Jackie Robinson theme to them. The out-group becoming in, the outsider proving himself, herself, the person who was discounted now suddenly emerging as a triumphant figure. And I think there's a lot of hope in that, particularly if you see the way the basketball teams play, the affection
Absolutely.
That binds the teams together. On the other hand, they get a lot of hate mail. It's true. So not everybody is willing to embrace that story. But in a way, I take your suggestion as a good one, because the fact that people are upset by women's sports, the sisterhood among the women who play the sports, the fact that they upset means that something is happening. Somebody's ideas are being tested. And that's the creative work of the culture. That's the creative work of myth-making.
What will be resolved in this presidential campaign of 2024?
It's a critical moment, because if Trump wins, then the political equation may change so radically that the cultural questions involved become secondary. And there's just no predicting how that will go. I use a quote in the book from Daniel Patrick Moynihan that the central conservative truth is that culture is more important than politics.
Yes.
The central liberal truth is that politics can save us from our culture. And the problem is that it's not clear that the politics of the present moment can save us from the culture war. And that's what I think is at stake in the election. And I think will remain at stake even if Biden wins.
Hmm.
The issues are so deep set at this point, I don't think they can be resolved in a positive way by Biden winning. I think that the disorder will continue, the violence will continue. It will take a particular form in particular states. If Trump wins, the violence will go the other way. It'll be state violence. Hmm. It will change the equation, the political environment, in ways that I think are completely unpredictable.
I think we need a different journalism to cover this aspect of our politics. Nobody likes these horse race contests of pollsters, basically. Why not a scorecard of which ideas are catching on, which feelings are taking root?
Yeah.
In the mythic department.
I'm for that.
I'd love you to score the myths. How did the myths do this week? The settler myth is losing out to the good war myth.
The good war myth is kind of up front. And with the Donald Trump trials, it's kind of irrelevant to the stuff I'm talking about. I would be listening now for things like Carrie Lake, I think it was, who said that this election is critical, you better get a gun, or words to that effect. I mean, when that starts going on, then you know the myth is being called. Either the Second Amendment founding or the lost cause is being invoked. And that's what I would listen for now.
You've given us a whole different way to think of what we're looking at, and I'd love to do it again. Richard Slotkin, this is enormously interesting, and we're hugely grateful for the book and this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Richard Slotkin is Professor Emeritus of English and American Studies at Wesleyan University. His new book in a decorated series is A Great Disorder, National Myth and the Battle for America. Here at Open Source, we depend on listener support. If you haven't done your part yet, seize the moment. Visit radioopensource.org/donate and pitch in to keep the world's first and longest running podcast going strong. Open Source is proud to be a member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-based collective of independent, creator-owned podcasts. Our shows range from history and art to politics and technology. We come together around the principle that independent voices are more important than ever. You can learn more at hubspokeaudio.org. And thank you for listening all the way.